Welcome to episode 16 of the Interracial John Podcast. I'm your host, At Leslie Mack, and I'm joined as always by...
At Very White Guy.
And you're very white indeed. Episode 16. Here we are, chugging along. It's a Wednesday. This week's going by fast, man.
It has.
Very, very fast. It's kind of crazy. So let's see.
Did you want to read where people can find us?
Stitcher, iTunes, Radio? Let's do that. So you can find us on iTunes and also Stitcher Radio. Just search Interracial John. That's J-A-W-N. You can also find us on our website, which is interracialjohn.com. And we are on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, at Interracial John. Again, that's J-A-W-N. And you can follow me on Twitter at Leslie Mack, M-A-C.
And me at Very White Guy.
That's right. And we're actually going to be joined a little bit later in the show by a freelance writer and project consultant named Leah Allen. So I'm excited about that. We're going to talk about using boycotts as a form of economic protest. That'll be kind of cool.
The Black Friday blackout. I like
it. Yeah, it's going to be neat. So I guess we'll start. Why don't we start with some Ferguson updates? Because there's been a lot of stuff going on and just things kind of happening.
Get right into the heavy stuff.
Yeah.
Well, so I had a video clip I wanted to play from Tef Poe.
Oh, great.
He was on Ebony. See if I can pull this up here.
This is on Ebony.com, right?
Yeah, Ebony.com.
Yeah.
And the problem with the situation is this. I, as a concerned citizen, sit here and tell you that we are in a situation of distress. You're in a room of people that are telling you that this is a situation where things can get real. Shit that nobody wants to happen can and will happen. People will be hurt. People will die. You're comfortable sitting next to me knowing that I physically put myself out there on the line every day with these people. You're comfortable with the idea that I might not be here. You really ultimately don't give a shit if I die out there protesting in Ferguson. To me, that's the problem. They try to find these really mechanical responses to our problems.
She tells you about the public office.
Right. That's a mechanical response. I'm responding from a humanistic level. Emotion, concern, hurt, pain. Just the basic idea that, you know, I don't even know Mike Brown. Never knew him, never met him. But he's dead in the middle of the street, so I have to respond to that. I'm a human. So
I'll just stop it there. I thought that was a really good. I can't disavow him with that opinion.
No.
That a lot of white folks, I don't want to say don't care, but there's no other way to describe it.
Yeah, and it also like was something that I noticed when that Justice for Mike Brown thing happened at the St. Louis Symphony, that the looks on a lot of the white people's faces in the room, they were like, who the hell's Mike Brown? Like, they really like just didn't even know. And these are people in the community that this is occurring in. And you said to me yesterday, you were like, well, I think a lot of white people don't even know about Ferguson. And I was like, are you kidding me? You really think that they don't even know about it?
I know they don't know.
And you're like, yeah, they don't know anything about it.
Yeah, I know. Well, and so the phrase you don't know what you don't know, right? So like you think you know a lot of things,
right?
And you're aware of the things that you don't know,
right?
But you're unaware of the vast world of shit you don't know that you don't know,
right?
And for white people, we've talked about this on the White Privilege Podcast. You know, we go through our whole lives not ever needing to step out of our comfort zone, never ever needing to consider what it must be like for a person of color. And converse, and that's the essence of white privilege, and converse, people of color have to go through their whole lives every day first assessing how they're going through the world and then assessing how they're going through the white world.
Yeah.
Right? Like you know, people of color are day in, day out, constantly going outside of their comfort zone, thinking about the other person, white people in this situation. White people, not only do they not have to do that, they almost conditioned not to do that.
And
to sort of close their eyes to it.
Yeah, and to treat any request for that as some sort of affront to their whiteness.
Yeah. That's crazy.
Like, that's where that charge of anybody who brings race into a conversation, like, well, you're being racist.
Quit race baiting. The race card.
It's like, because I'm asking you to stop thinking as only a white person, that's racist.
It's totally crazy.
It doesn't even make sense.
One, I don't know if we talked about it on this podcast or the White Privilege podcast, but the fact that, you know, at our liberal progressive church, very liberal, very progressive, we get, you know, not that exact, like, why are you bringing up the race card? And we did get that to some degree. But people that I care about will have on that same sort of spectrum, right? So it's not quite like, you know, why do you care about this? But they'll say, like, well, what, you know, why Mike Brown? What's so different about Ferguson? Or what about the, they have ways of talking about it that just so clearly they're distancing themselves from the reality of the human aspect of this. They're thinking of it in some sort of, you know,
abstract.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's true. I've heard that, I've had that question asked of me by a lot of white people. It's like, what's so special about this one? Yeah. It's like, why does it need to be something special?
Enough's enough.
And why do I need to justify me caring about anything? I've never justified you caring about, I don't know, Lululemon pants.
Yeah.
Why do you care about them? I don't give a shit.
Well, and you know what's really, and I don't want to say it's crazy, but, and I don't mean to disparage the plight of animals in captivity, but you remember how much noise white people made about Shamu and fucking...
Oh, my God. The Blackwater thing.
Yeah. There was a whole... I mean, it was shown at our church. People mm-hmm. were like, oh, we got to do something. Why is it that white people are so easy and readily to empathize with a whale in a tank, but not... millions of people of color sitting in around us and out our windows on a day-to-day basis?
Because they don't fear the whale in a tank. And they are afraid of black people.
Yeah.
Oof. They are afraid of the very real and justified rage that black people have. Because they've never been forced to confront it. And so the idea of it is truly frightening to them.
Mm.
That's why.
It's crazy. Well, more on Ferguson, right? So there was the state of emergency.
Yeah, so Governor Jay Nixon has declared a state of emergency in Missouri, presumably ahead of the grand jury announcement, which is kind of crazy to me. These are normally used for literally weather emergencies like hurricanes right. and things like that. And the scary thing about state of emergencies is that it basically declares martial law in a state and removes a lot of civil rights that you normally would have, and you don't have them anymore, and empowers the state to take actions against you that it never would be able to do legally. And it also protects the state and its entities yep. from those actions that they may undertake while under this state of emergency.
It's almost like a preemptive, like, hey, we're gonna fuck you guys up.
Oh, it's not preemptive.
And we don't want to be like, held
for
accountable.
Sure. It's yeah. like, yeah, we're gonna fuck you up, and you're not gonna be able to sue us
exactly
or complain
right.
about it or say shit because it's a state of emergency, and you black motherfuckers are the reason why we had to do this.
Yeah, don't bother with any sort of lawsuits because we protected ourselves. State of emergency.
And it's so funny. Even in his original, his like big press conference he did to announce it, his first thing he started talking about was
property,
which is white people. And then secondary, never mention Mike Brown.
Never
mention Darren Wilson.
Nope.
It's just kind of crazy to me.
Well, that was the whole violence
it's
will
surreal.
Not be tolerated
it's
bullshit.
Surreal. It's surreal. It's like you can't even believe that it's actually happening like this and that everybody in this country isn't looking around like, okay. But it reminds me of that story. I think it was from World War II where, you know, first they came for my neighbor.
Right.
Then they came for so-and-so. Then they came, and then finally they came for me and there was nobody there to talk for me. And I don't understand how especially poor white people, especially middle-class white people, do not see that this could happen to them. The next time something occurs that they do, that rich people decide is not what they want to happen, it can happen to you too. Injustice for one is injustice for all, and justice for one is justice for all. And I don't understand how, you know, people don't see it. I don't get it.
They don't want to see it. It's willfully deluding that, you know, and we had this discussion the other day that, and I don't know the answer is how many people in the spectrum of white people that are not actively combating racism, how many are profiting and they are aware and they're just deliberately burying their head in the sand? How many are maybe uninformed, you know, ignorant on some level? And I thought this is a good point that you made, that no matter where a white person is, their culpability lies in the fact that they have never once tried. They have once tried to step outside their comfort zone. So even if you think, wow, I can't believe it, I'm newly awoke, how stupid, I've been living under a rock and in a cave, but that's your fault. You got to turn that finger around and be like, you were living under a rock. You were living in a cave. You were deliberately not engaging with people of color. You were deliberately not, inviting people of color into your social networks and listening to them. You know what I mean? Like, is it? So I've tacked a little bit. I used to give a lot of white people maybe not a pass, but like, well, they're not aware. Our history's been whitewashed. They're not aware. And now I'm sort of more like, you know what? They're not aware, and they fucking are fine not being aware. They're totally cool with not being aware, because being aware to them would upset their delicate egg white omelet sensibilities. Mm-hmm. You know,
Albumin. So let's play. Just there was the big press conference that Jay Nixon held, and then he does a weekly conference call with the media as well. And so this week's media conference call was interesting, and this is something that's been batted around about Governor Nixon for a while, which is that when he's on script, he's a very good communicator, but the minute he's off script, he sounds like a buffoon. So this is just a little piece of the conference call. And again, this is a weekly thing he does, and this is directly with the media where they have an opportunity to ask him questions via a conference call.
Here we go.
Next question. We go next to Matthew Sledge with Huffington Post.
Hi, Governor. Thank you. Given that you've declared the state of emergency and you put the Highway Patrol on the Unified Command, does the buck ultimately stop with you when it comes to how many protests are policed?
Well, honey, our goal here is to keep the peace and allow folks' voices to be heard. And in that balance, I'm attempting, using the resources we have to marshal to be predictable for both those pillars. I don't spend a tremendous amount of time personalizing this vis-a-vis me. I'm trying to make sure that that we move forward in a predictable, peaceful manner that plans for all contingencies that might occur, so that people of a disparate group of opinions and actions can be heard, while at the same time the property and persons of people in the St. Louis region are protected. So.
I'm just going to – I can't hear him fucking stammer anymore. What a fucking tool bag.
So he doesn't know where the buck stops.
And did you hear him go back to the property?
Oh, yeah. Property first, then persons. And I just – it's just crazy to me. He's asked, like, so you've unified everything under one, and you're the one making the decisions, right? Am I making the decision? He doesn't even know.
I interpret that almost as, again, a sidestepping of culpability.
Yeah.
What's a unified command? What does that fucking mean?
Yeah.
Who's in charge? What's a unified command?
Are you in charge?
Who's fucking in charge? What's a unified command? So when shit goes down, if shit goes down and they are going to violate rights again, they'll say, well, it was this, it was that. It was a unified command.
Yeah.
And this whole go back to the property thing, you know whose message was real on point? You know who's in alignment with Governor Nixon's press conferences?
Who's that?
The KKK.
Well, yes.
The exact same fucking thing. Yes. Our daily lives and property.
Their daily lives.
That's who you want to fucking be in alignment with.
No, it's true. So obviously there's been a bunch of, as you said, military vehicles, Homeland Security vehicles moving into the St. Louis area. This has been happening for weeks, clearly in preparation of the state to go against literally people who are meeting on a daily basis to talk about resisting violence, being their rights being violated and still keeping their calm, and having some very simple ways for them to get their points across. And the state's response has been to act and militarize the entire region, which is kind of crazy to me.
And, you know, this just occurred to me right now. I wonder if the overreaction and response, militarization response, is in some way to reinforce the status quo of the narrative for white people that black people are the problem, right?
Oh, definitely.
So if they came out peacefully, they'd be like, oh, wow, black people are being peaceful, and this is – maybe we should listen. But coming out with an iron fist, all these white people can say, look, they're thugs and animals, and we had to squash them down with fucking tanks and shit. You know what I mean?
What do you think they said about Martin Luther King Jr.?
Yeah.
They put him in jail.
Yeah.
He was an outside agitator.
COINTELPRO was there for a reason.
Okay. Literally, this is what he's referred to. in Alabama. He's an outside agitator. He's from Mississippi. What's he doing here?
That's crazy. Well, and let's move on, but I want to just mention that there was a guy who got fired from a hotel mm-hmm. for simply taking a picture and posting it about an armory of DHS vehicles that are maybe 30 minutes outside of Ferguson. He's a vet. He's a guy who works at a hotel. So just the depths that people are going to maintain this narrative and the status quo is just outrageous.
And you know, like, literally the way the guy got fired was Homeland Security was like, call them, was like, well, we'll take all of these people out of your hotel if you don't fire the guy. So it's like crazy. This is our government that is now taking away a citizen's right to have their job for posting something. Anybody could have walked there with their eyes to see. It wasn't in a secret place. It was in their fucking parking lot. It's craziness.
Yeah. And I'll leave on this, that I forget where I saw this quote, but without accountability, there can be no rule of law. If Wilson is not indicted or is underindicted, the clear message is that it is open season on people of color, that St. Louis has declared that Darren Wilson is not a criminal, but that the people who live under the thumb of oppression of Darren Wilson's in this country are. It would say to the cry of Black Lives Matter that, nope, they really don't. And that's the truth.
Yeah, because it is a lot bigger than just Darren Wilson. So I do like to make sure that we get that out there as well. We're going to take a quick break because we do have a bit of a sponsor today. So let's play that. This episode of the Interracial John podcast is brought to you by the Ferguson National Response Network, an online listing of planned responses around the country to the Darren Wilson grand jury announcement. Visit fergusonresponse.tumblr.com for full information. 91 cities and 30 states have already planned their actions. Find your city, add your city, share and prepare. Visit fergusonresponse.tumblr.com. Okay, welcome back to the Interracial John podcast. I want to introduce our special guest today. White guy, we have a special guest. Are you excited?
I'm always excited. I'm very easily excited.
That's true. Well, today we are joined by Leah Allen, who is a freelance writer and project consultant. By day, she works as a property development manager for a private real estate firm and writes freelance for various agencies. She's also a member of the newly founded Coalition Against Police Violence, and the acronym for that is CAPV, an organization committed to creating social change in America's justice system through economic empowerment. And she resides in Atlanta, Georgia. So welcome, Leah, to the Interracial John.
Welcome.
Thank you. Very, very glad to be here.
Awesome. So I know that, tell us a little bit more about the Coalition Against Police Violence. How did it get started and kind of what's it all about?
Absolutely. So Coalition Against Police Violence, or CAPV as you referred to, is basically a team of organizers. We are small but mighty right now. And we have come together to really partner with and unify other organizations throughout America that are boycotting specifically to fight injustice in our justice system. And we have a mission which is really about partnership. We really want to be an organization that supports a lot of the great initiatives and causes that are happening across America and be a voice for people that don't have a voice, to push for social and legislative reform by really using our wallet as the weapon to fight back, if you will.
Excellent. And so is there a boycott that's coming up? Do you guys have something already planned? And what type of organizations are you working with?
Yes, we do. We're very excited. We've got a partnership with a few different organizations, and one is Total Blackout for Reform. And it's based out of Chicago, and also Hands Up United, which is based out of St. Louis, Missouri. And we've got an initiative coming up, which is actually going to kick off on Black Friday. It's called Blackout, Total Blackout. And it runs from Black Friday all the way to January 3rd. And we are encouraging any and everyone, particularly folks of color, but all of our allies, to come together and really to make a change. On Black Friday, we're actually asking folks not to spend any money at all. And Black Saturday, I guess the day following Black Friday, all the way through very end of December, we are asking folks to really shop Black-owned businesses. And there are a few key businesses that we're targeting to say, hey, if you can, please don't spend your money here. one of which would be, you know, Walmart. Lots of controversy there. I don't really know anyone who likes Walmart, but we are excited about that and hoping to really see this sustained next year so that we got some momentum and people that are supporting and rallying behind us, because I think this is really important.
Excellent. And Drew, what do you think about, I know we've had this discussion before about economic boycotting and kind of what the impact can be.
You asking what I think?
Yeah.
I mean, I absolutely agree that the wallet, right? Economic, taking the dollar out of the equation, that's almost always how change happens, right? You know, when you look at systems and situations, people don't do the right thing. They don't do the just thing. They don't do the humanitarian thing. Companies don't do that until there's a dollars and cents to it, right? Until there's a PR reason, a financial reason for them to make some specific changes. So I believe fully in using leverage when it comes to your spending and the dollar. In terms of the boycott, I'm not saying I have trouble with it. I wonder to what extent, because like Black Friday is just such a, you know, it's like a part of Americana these days, right? It, like people camp out and they want to shop with their family and then they go eating afterwards. So I don't know to what extent, A, people are going to buy into it. I am. I know I'm not going to. And we've already boycotted Black Friday for many years, not just because it's like, you know, aggravating to
and
some
crazy,
degree.
Crazy.
Yeah. Just, you know, people getting beat up for a $200 TVs is just absurd to me. So I'll participate myself. But and I wonder, Leah, if you've got thoughts on to what extent boycotting the business. I think there's two questions I have. One, you know, there are families on the lower end of the socioeconomic status that need those sales and discounts. They rely on those opportunities to be able to get, you know, gifts and goods for family members. So I wonder to what extent the boycott will be able to reach those individuals to have participation, because it doesn't, in my mind, really work until the number's big, unless you've got a significant amount of people. If only 5% of people opt out of Black Friday, may not be noticed. 25-30% opt out, that'll definitely be seen in the balance sheet. So one is, you know, how do we get buy-in? How do you get buy-in from everyone? And then two, there are, you know, realistically, in particular at places like Walmart, people of color that are employed there. And if we're boycotting an industry, a group, let's just use Walmart as the hypothetical, does that, you know, have an ancillary impact on individuals working there that rely on that job? And I think on some level, you know, the situation we're trying to change, you know, social justice, police brutality. I'm not saying that those people shouldn't be considered in the equation, but, you know, I don't know. That's where, and maybe that's my privileged kind of white guy perspective, that I wonder, you know, to what extent we can get support and buy-in on a significant level to tip the scale. And then if we do, is there impact for people that are actually working at these establishments that, you know, need those jobs?
Sure, Drew, I think you bring up some really good questions, and those are questions that I've asked myself, even just as a consumer. So on the front end of really getting the buy-in and support of everyone, particularly on Black Friday, we know that it's going to be tough, and we know that a lot of people and all families all across this country really look forward to that. And no matter how dangerous or kind of crazy it seems to get out there, it seems like every year the hype builds up more and more for Black Friday and for shoppers to get out there. So we're aware that we won't have 100% participation. Of course, that's just the reality of what we have to accept. But we definitely think that there is power in unity and strength in numbers when it comes to really going after specific companies and groups. And I know that Walmart in particular is one that is actually being targeted on multiple angles this year. For the first time that I know about, where lots of different groups, whether it is folks fighting for police brutality or for environmental protection or for child labor laws or for the minimum wage, lots of people are getting behind this rally of attack, so to speak, in terms of boycotting Walmart as a business and an organization. So, you know, while on the one hand there is the reality of dealing with the fact that it will be difficult to convince some people not to shop at all on Black Friday, I'm hoping that the support that we have from all these different groups will actually make us stronger. And in terms of the folks and families who are actually employees of these companies, these corporations, there's definitely lots of things that will have to be really implemented long term. And so I don't see this as a short term thing where we do this for this one day or this one month, and then we just kind of leave people to it. We are working on providing folks with resources, anywhere from where to shop if you want to understand what your alternatives are, Black-owned businesses or businesses that are even just allies where we say, you know what, these guys, you know, aren't capitalists or corporatists. They, from a legislative standpoint, they seem to have a humanitarian core and ideal. And then on the flip hand, it's making sure that folks do have, you know, a place to work and where they get their bread and butter and how they bring food home, put food on the table is really important to us as well. So, and that's kind of a problem, again, that I've thought about, but it's going to definitely take a long-term approach.
Yeah.
I think the Coalition Against Police Violence, we're really looking to get large corporations' attention. And even those, you know, private sector lobbyists, we need to find a way to disrupt the bottom line and to get their attention. And so the ways that we do that will be through events like the Blackout, but also, like I said, sustaining that and giving people the right resources so that they understand it's not just about the power of the dollar. It's really about the power of our lives, and it's more than money.
And do you think that if you were to target, let's say, just Walmart specifically, that the impact would be more readily seen, right? So if we can't, you know, we're agreeing that people are going to shop regardless on Black Friday. But if there was an actual dip and you were to see, you know, they have these reports that come out like a week later, say, here's how everyone did on Black Friday.
They come out like the next day.
Yeah, but wouldn't it be great if Walmart had a big dip and it just, and there was a direct correlation to the action that Leah and other groups are taking? That, you know, versus an across the board dip. And the other, and I, you brought up a good point about Black owned businesses, and I struggle myself, right? So I'm thinking of the Made in America label, and what does that really mean? Does that mean assembled in America, distributed in America? Does that mean that the raw goods were in America? In the same sense, I wonder, you know, is there an easy way and a clear way to define what a Black-owned business is? Because you could have a retailer on a small main street that's a Black-owned business, but all the goods and things in there are maybe from larger distributors and manufacturers that are white-owned. And does that – so maybe – I don't know if you've had that distinction clear in your end, Leah, but sort of what does Black-owned mean in this respect? Where should we be shopping?
Sure. That's a really good point. You know, I have to be honest in terms of thinking about where products are manufactured. That's probably another layer to this that I haven't really dug deep into. But when it comes to defining, I guess, so to speak, what Black-owned businesses are, there are some things that I've thought about there, too. Because when we say even just Black, what does that mean? There are, I know, at least here in Atlanta, I've got friends, and there's lots of communities and families that thrive and support each other through African-owned businesses, you know. And if I were to do a comparison of some of those businesses that are African-owned to African-American-owned businesses, there's probably a little bit of a disparity there as well. So I think the first thing is just kind of looking at this and understanding, you know, who Black folk are and what does it mean to support one another in that sense. I have also looked at it just from an economic standpoint, Drew, and I don't think I necessarily have a solution right now, but it's something that we'll continue to think about. But I look at the socioeconomic ladder, and I look at that just in, you know, the Black community. And if you're talking about Black-owned businesses, if we are to support them, is that money going to be dispersed properly? You know, we've got lots of middle-class to upper-class families that thrive and do very well with Black businesses. Now, wherever they get those products from or who makes them, I'm not 100% sure. But you know, that does well, does that trickle down into the lower class? So that's something as well that I have thought about, and I'm looking to explore that more. So I don't know if I have an answer on that, but I will say that piece that you brought up about Made in America, that's very interesting.
Well, I don't know if you need to have an answer. You know, I think on some level, and there's a, you know, we've talked about this, Leslie, that we just, you know, people need to be heard, right? We don't need to have an answer, right? And when we talk about Ferguson and Mike Brown, we don't need, you know, this, we're not asking for specific action, just an indictment, just arrest Darren Wilson. You know, then the next step, right? So it doesn't have to, I don't think you need to have the answer, but I think that having the coalition and the cohesion in a sort of unified way to take the and the you know call the black dollar whatever you call it, but 13% of our country they spend like everybody else. That's a significant impact. And when you look at civil justice and action that's been taken before, I mean that was Montgomery, Selma. These were boycotts, and they had an impact. That absolutely is a not just a good way, but it's a defined way that has worked in the past, and there's no reason to think that it can't work now. And just because we have questions doesn't mean that it's an invalid action or that you will or won't figure those out as you move along. But first step is be heard. And the way to be heard is to take the dollars off the table. That, you know, hit them in the wallet and they'll notice, right?
And I think it's a little bit about flexing that muscle, too, to say, hey, when we say something, this is what can happen from it, because that's what lobbyists do. They say, hey, if you don't do what we want you to do, we have all these people here that are going to not vote for you, or they're not going to support you, or they're going to come out against you. And so that's the other part of it. And that's the sustainability that I think an organization like CAPV can fill, because there isn't a lever to pull right now to say, hey, look, this is where black people are looking when something happens, when something is going to need to occur economically, and we want to respond in that way. Who's leading that charge? Who's making that known? And I think this is something I've been talking about a lot with a lot of people, which is this switch from, I would say, old guard civil rights organizations and activists to a younger, new generation, millennial, and maybe even a little bit older than millennial, because I'm not a millennial, but this newer generation of activism, which is a lot more, it's just very different. And so part of that is that right now, I don't think that there are levers in place. You know, the NAACP is an organization, but what lever do they pull? Do black people listen to what they say anymore? I don't think so. And I don't think there is a body like the Southern Leadership Coalition anymore. There isn't something like that to say, because I think that younger people don't identify with that. And also, I think that those organizations are so entrenched in the system that it's difficult for them to accept money, which they do, from these large entities, and then on the other hand say, hey, don't go to Walmart. It's difficult for them. Probably impossible, actually, to be perfectly honest.
Right.
So that's where I think the sustainability part of it is really important. And you have to start somewhere. If you flex right now and we get, you know, 3%, great. The next time we flex, if it builds to 7%, it's about building that and getting people used to this idea that when you hear that this is what we're going to do, that everybody listens to it and acts on it as well. So that's where I see the strength coming in.
I agree. And, you know, the two kind of related thoughts I'm thinking is that, one, as best I can tell, black culture is one of the most profitable exports that we have, right? Music, you know, all the stuff that people of color contribute, but then we as a society co-opt, package, and sell to a bunch of other people. And then, you know, go back to, was it Tulsa, Oklahoma, Black Wall Street, right? So that there hasn't either, when people of color have had their own, and I think a lot of times people will point to other groups that have come to the United States in various ways, like, you know, oh, there's, you know, Chinese folk in Philadelphia, and they have Chinatown, they've got their own this and that, because they keep it all together. The economic loop is closed. And for people of color, that was happening in Black Wall Street, and white people got scared and torched it to the ground. And I think that, you know, if we can flex this muscle, as Leslie said, and flex it very effectively, it will be heard. You know, that will be unmistakable. And it's needed. I think people of color need to kind of have control of that dialogue, right? The flow of money. And the only way to, I don't know of any other way to do it than to cut it off in very strategic ways at specific times like you're doing, Leah. So I support it fully, and I'm a part of the Facebook group for Total Blackout, and I'm all on board. I will not be shopping specifically for those periods of time. Has to be done.
Awesome. I appreciate that support so much, and as you guys were talking, you're absolutely right. We got to dig a little bit deeper and do that in order to sustain the movement. And like you mentioned, Leslie, you know, Ferguson is not the first event of its kind, but it has definitely sparked, I think, a full awakening in America's social conscious, if in anything, if in no one else, but in young activists all over America, and I'm really all over the world. And so we've got to take that as an opportunity and use that to speak. And like you said, Drew, it's, money is sometimes the only voice that we have, and it seems like people don't really pay attention, but everybody talks that language. So when we start pulling it, hopefully they'll wake up and pay attention. And, you know, the reverse of it is looking at those people that we can support and encourage, and whether they are, you know, legislators and folks in the political arena themselves who make a lot of these decisions about these policies, such as the 1033 program, such as the inconsistency from state to state, and even at a local level with police departments and the equipment that they use or don't use. You know, we've got to put some money and some energy behind those folks as well and say, you know, let's support them. And I think that's what might differentiate us and make us a little bit different from some of those groups that traditionally, as you mentioned, Leslie, like the NAACP, like, you know, the Southern Leadership Coalition and SPLC and other groups that really were behind the boycott, which a lot of those were churches.
Yep.
We can get into a whole new discussion about
them. You sure can. We'll have to have you on another time to talk about that.
Absolutely. But this is really it's revolutionary in terms of how we're approaching it. And so we've got to take this moment now and not let go.
Yeah, you know, we've talked about this, Leslie, but I really do think there needs to be a political action committee like the Black Pack. And if somebody like Oprah or the guy that owned BET, just get like some really wealthy Black folk to just fund this thing and put, you know, $10 million, whatever it is, into a political action committee that's lobbying specifically solely for people of color. And you could have a, you know, I would start with H.R. 40, John Conyers' bill to study reparations. Just, are you going to vote when this comes up on the table? Yes. Let's be clear. It's not that this bill has been shot down. It hasn't even been up for a vote. They can't even get a quorum of people to say, yes, let's put this on the Senate floor and discuss it. Why can't there be a PAC that says we're going to have, you know, all these people voting, and if you don't agree and you don't vote to discuss H.R. 40, you're out?
Well, part of the issue there, though, is that your assumption is that Bob Johnson, who's the former owner of BET that you're referring to, and Oprah, you assume that their interests are aligned with Black people.
Fair enough.
It's a big assumption to make. I don't think that that's necessarily true.
Well, maybe not Bob and Oprah, but get this thing funded, and, you know, there just needs to be a PAC. There needs to be a political action committee that's leveraging people of color's interests, because that it's not happening as best I can tell.
Right. That's, I think, if I was not mistaken, I was checking on you all's blog, and you talked about that before, Leslie, around Black celebrities. And whether they're speaking or not, it is speaking volumes, especially right now in the heat of this movement.
Yeah.
And but folks like Oprah and Bob Johnson, like you mentioned, they might not have Black interests in mind. They have the interests of the rich in mind, though.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
that's how we've got to connect that disparity as well, where, you know, we have to think of ourselves as united and all part, all Black folks as being part of the diaspora and united in understanding that Black lives do matter, and it's not just the lives of the rich and wealthy.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Well, Lee, I want to give you an opportunity to just tell everyone where they can reach the Coalition Against Police Violence and where else they should be looking for you as well.
Absolutely. So one of the best ways to reach out to us is via email, and that email address is contact.capv, that's contact.capv@gmail.com, and we do our best to respond to those emails very quickly. We've also recently established a Twitter account, and lots of information around the blackout will be posted there. But feel free to check out our partners as well. Total Blackout Reform, For Reform has a Facebook page. They've got information about what we're doing as a coalition as well. So those are some of the best ways to contact us. And continue to be on the lookout for more information. I'm very thankful and excited for you guys to have me on your show here just to kind of increase that awareness. So I appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
And what's the Twitter handle for the coalition?
Yes, thank you. The Twitter handle and also the same handle for Instagram, @StopBadPolicing.
Awesome. I love that. Stop Bad Policing. So @StopBadPolicing, B-A-D. Awesome. And I know you're going to be on the Americans United Again podcast as well this week, right?
Yes, I'm looking forward to that. That's going to be Friday at 2 p.m., I believe.
Ricky and Sherelle.
Awesome. They're great. You're going to have a great time there.
I'd be remiss if I didn't let you go to say, get a Varsity hot dog and burger for me. Is Varsity still the place to do? Right? Isn't that downtown Atlanta?
The Varsity, yes, it is. Oh, my goodness.
And what was the, whenever I visited, my brother used to say, you know, turn left at the Big Chicken. I thought, what's he talking about? And there's a statue of some giant chicken. I forget what that is, but maybe that's somewhere else in Atlanta.
Right. Yeah, over in Marietta, the Big Chicken. That's the old, I guess, one of the first.
Chick-fil-A's, right? Oh, KFC's or whatever. Yeah. Okay. You always bring it back to food somehow, Drew. I don't know how you manage
that. Well, it's dinner time. We're recording at dinner time. I'm hungry.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks again, Leah. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks. Bye-bye.
So thanks again to Leah Allen for joining us today, and we will have links to the Coalition Against Police Violence and also the Twitter links, how you can get in touch with them, in the show notes for today's episode.
Terrific.
Yeah.
You know, and speaking, basically we were talking about just to be heard, that the boycott is to be able to have voices heard. Mm-hmm. Did you hear about the group of young black men at Booker T. Washington that had to walk out of class because of a tweet?
Mm.
Here, let me play. I have an audio clip from ABC News. Let me cue it up.
Okay.
Charged tweet. Students at a Norfolk high school say they're fed up and disappointed. At the center of controversy, this tweet right here. Students say a school administrator retweeted it and they want her held accountable.
So the photo, I think it made the rounds on social media, but it was of a high school, I guess a dance or a prom, and it had about seven or eight young men, African-American men, and seven or eight young women, white women, all posing together. And the photo went around, and this is an administrator, this is like an official Twitter account of the school, tweeted, "Every white girl's father's worst nightmare or nah," with a picture of these kids at their prom, literally, from an official account. Finish this audio clip.
Willa Robertson is live at Booker T. Washington High School, where students gathered outside of the school today in protest.
Yeah, about 15 students walked out of the doors here at Booker T. Washington High School this afternoon. They say they're disappointed in this entire situation and how it's been handled so far. They say they feel like protesting was the only way to get their point across. It's this retweet that stirred up controversy at Booker T. Washington High School.
It was individually hurtful for me, being an African-American male. I know it's hurtful for everybody.
The tweet, allegedly sent out by a school administrator, shows seven white girls accompanied by seven young black men to what looks like a dance. The caption, "Every white girl's father's worst nightmare." The original tweet from this account is one that's gone viral. But either way, students say it's hurtful to see, especially coming from a leader at a predominantly black school.
And, you know, did you catch that, Leslie? The person said allegedly, when this is known, it's been sent, and they referred to girls and then black men.
Mm-hmm. Young black men.
God damn it. But so again, just the point that you know, just to be heard, and they're not asking for this person to be fired, to be pilloried. They just want an acknowledgement that you sent this and it was hurtful.
And I had read that they went to the school board and they had no response. They never even responded to their request for action and to be heard.
Yeah.
They just ignored them.
Well, and you know, the modern 1-2 sidestep, they first denied it, then they deleted the tweet, and they deleted the entire account.
Yeah.
So, it didn't happen. We deleted it. But that's just crazy. You had something about kids and race as well, right?
Well, I just wanted to talk a little bit about it. Just reminded me about conversations that, you know, black parents versus white parents have to have, and just the idea and thoughts that kids have about race. Now, this is a predominantly black school, and so all of these white young ladies that go to the school, their dates were black. I'm sure that's a big pool of the boys that they're able to date.
Not surprising at Booker T. Washington High School.
Not a surprise. So to even have that be something like, oh, it's so shocking. Because for them, I'm sure it's not, because they wouldn't think of it that way. Obviously, these are their dates, the person that asked them to the prom or their boyfriend or whatever it might be. And it reminded me of our nieces, Faith and Zoe, where one time my niece came home and said to my sister, what does it mean there's a girl in my class? And she said she was mixed, and I don't know what that means. And so my sister was like, oh, it just means that her two parents are different races, like one's black and one's white. And she said, like, if Aunt Leslie and Uncle Drew had a baby, their baby would be mixed. And my niece, without missing a beat, looked at my sister and said, wait, I thought Auntie Leslie was white.
I started me to laugh at that.
No.
I love Faith.
I love her. And my sister calls me immediately. She's like, you're not going to believe what Janice just said. She thought that you were white. And I said, well, ask Zoe, who's a little bit younger, what she thinks of this. And she asked Zoe. Zoe agrees. Yes, she assumed I was white as well. So my sister starts asking, well, do you think I'm white? She says, no. Mm-mm. And I'm lighter complexion than my sister. Zoe's lighter complexion than Faith is. So she asked Faith, okay, well, I'm black. Yeah, Mom, you're black. What about Zoe? Is Zoe black? Yeah, Zoe's black. Why is Aunt Leslie white then? And their answer was very simple. They figured because I married you, that made me white.
My whiteness trumps all.
Yeah, not that it trumps all.
I'm so white.
In their head, they had just been like, oh, yeah, white people marry each other. Black people marry each other. Therefore, despite the fact that, yes, my sister's black and they're my nieces and they're black, that I was white. So it just got me thinking about, like, kids, they think about race in a very different way until they're conditioned that way. And then it got me thinking about that conversation that black parents have to have with their sons and daughters to let them know how to go about their life in the world. You know, that point where at what age is a black boy when he learns that he's scary?
Yeah.
And what that does to the psyche. I had read a thing the other day about a woman on Facebook had posted that her son had walked by a car and the woman in the car locked her door.
Yeah.
Her son's 11.
11.
And he knew.
She wrote it even like, you know, thank you, woman in Walmart, for locking your door fucking loudly.
Because now I have to I thought I could wait a year or two more.
Yeah, I could wait till the teens.
Because he knew, he saw that it was him that made her have that reaction. And now she had to talk to him about it. And so on Gawker, they actually asked parents to send in, you know, what they say and what they have said.
Oh, how to have the talk.
And how to have the talk. So it's kind of interesting to hear. So this is one Angela Jackson Brown from Indianapolis. She's 46. She says, I've raised a white stepson who's 26 and my own black son who's 24. My conversations with them concerning the police are different depending on the circumstances they are entering into. When they are together, I've taught my white stepson that he will be treated for all practical purposes the same as his black stepbrother. He gets that his white privilege is null and void when he's hanging with the brothers, quote unquote. I've also taught my white stepson that when he is alone or with white friends, he'll be treated with a certain level of privilege that his black stepbrother will never know, and he has seen this happen time and time again. Ironically, he's the one that likes to sag his pants, yet he has never been harassed by the police, even in situations where he probably should have been. My black son, I've always taught him to treat the police the same way he would a Klansman, because in parts of the South where he grew up, they were often the same. He's taught to interact with them as little as possible, get stopped for a traffic violation, use your Sunday school manners, keep your hands where they can be seen, and above all else, do not argue. My daddy passed that lesson on to me, and sadly, if I have grandchildren, it seems they too will have to get this same dirty lesson.
Jesus.
Michael Sims Burton, he's in his 50s, he's from Alexandria, Virginia. I have a 24-year-old son. I've given him the talk. He's been with me when the police stopped me, primarily because the police recklessly eyeballed my son and didn't see me, the little old lady, driving the car. So he knows the drill. Ask the police before you reach for your license. Ask the police for permission to get your insurance card and registration out the glove box. Do not answer any questions. Just do as you're told. Once my son and I were getting out the car at a shopping mall, the police approached him and asked, did you just leave the mall? I intervened. I instructed my son to never, ever answer a question from the police. Ask the police, am I free to go? Do not answer any questions. Be polite, be cordial, but never answer any questions. Keep asking, am I free to go? Am I under arrest? What are the charges? May I make a phone call? However, do not move suddenly. Do not get smart alecky. Do not run. If the police start swinging, drop to the ground. Protect your head and vital organs by curling up in a ball on your knees. I've given my son this talk, and it terrifies me that in 2014, I text and call my son throughout the day, not because I miss him so much, but because I'm checking on his safety in this racist, militaristic society.
Golly. That's depressing, man.
I'm going to read one more. Fatima, she's 27. She's from Boston, Massachusetts. I gave my 7-year-old a talk about Ferguson. I was brutally honest, maybe too honest. I told him that the police put a target on black men in this country. I told him I'm angry because I don't want him dead or in jail one day for a crime he either didn't commit or because he was minding his business and a police officer sees he fits the profile. He asked if I thought he was going to die by the police one day. I told him that I don't think that will happen, but that I'm scared because I have no control over the police's actions. He was also scared, worried, troubled about what I had said. I'm sure up until that point, he had the impression that the police were there to protect people. I like being honest with my son. Mm. When he went to the rally in Boston with me, he was scared to even look at the police. That I feel a tiny bit of guilt for, but I think he should be scared of the police. I know I am. I'm scared for him. It's a continuous conversation for us, and I let him know that right now the police won't come after him, and that's only because he's 7. It's only a matter of time where he can't protect himself from the police solely because of how he looks, and it's only a matter of time before I can't protect him either. I see my son and all the victims who have died from police murder and brutality. Every last one of them. I can't even begin to imagine what Mike Brown's mother is going through. My son is my soul, my light of my life. I will gladly take any bullet, whatever, if that means he would be safe. But I can't protect him from the police, and that terrifies me. So I have to do something now to at least try to make change so my son can walk the streets freely and be protected instead of beaten, harassed, targeted, or murdered.
And, you know, that the couple of things that came to mind, the statistic that I think black men in particular are 2,000 times more likely to be killed or shot by police than their white counterparts.
Yeah.
And our podcast episode, was it 15, where you talked about the negative socializations that occur for black people as young as 3.
Mm-hmm.
So here she's having this talk at 7 thinking, well, it's maybe too young. No, you know, it's happening at 3. Right? As young as 3, these negative, perceptions of white people in terms of the, you know, the stereotypes and the tropes about people of color, they're happening, you know, at 7, that young man. And I think, I know I do, I often underestimate just how smart kids are and just how perceptive they are. You know, we don't think that they heard this or knew that or saw that. No, they picked it up. They got it, you know, real clear.
Yeah. One last thing about that, and this is from a white mother and father who have adopted 2 black children. They're talking about their black adoptive sons being stopped for DWB, driving while black, or shopping while black, SWB, something that they didn't occur to. So one African-American family that we became friends with when our sons were middle school told us that they didn't let their older son drive until they were comfortable that he knew how to be, quote, properly differential if he were pulled over by the police. Until then, it had never occurred to us that we would need to add training in, quote, how to act in the event that you're stopped by police to our list of teenage driving skills. So we had the talk with both of our sons before they learned to drive. While aching inside, we rattled off the drill. Show your hands. Smile. Do not appear threatening and never talk back. One of our sons insisted that he would sue any police officer who stopped him without cause, but we were pretty certain that he understood and would follow our instructions. We were all shocked, especially the boys, to learn the vital nature of our advice when their DWB came true. So, yeah, and this is one of those things that you were talking about, how white people are able to distance themselves from that. And I think about, you know, we have friends that have teenage sons, and they would never have to worry about their son ever being pulled over.
You know what they're doing? They're getting excited. I'm going to buy the first car. Yep. I'm going to get the insurance. I'm going to add him or her to the policy. Mm-hmm. I'm going to take him or her to the DMV.
Yep.
What's he or she going to wear for the photo? They don't think about any of that shit.
Nope.
You know, and I, when you were reading that thing, I've written about it on A Million Stories of White Privilege, and I'm not saying, like, I'm proud of this fact, but I have, like, in recent memory, not just been, like, belligerent, but, like, goddamn rude to cops that pull me over. Like, literally, like, rude to a cop that pulls me over. And not that I'm saying that's, like, white people should or shouldn't do this. I'm not, again, happy of that. But nobody arrested me. Nobody fucking thought negatively. Nobody in that interaction thought, here's an angry white guy. You know what I mean? It's just, I have that privilege. I literally have the privilege to be able to, if I so choose, and sometimes when I don't want to, accidentally, get kind of, like, belligerent with cops.
Mm-hmm.
And people of color not only not have that option, they've got to be deferential.
Yeah.
Hands on the steering wheel. Don't move too quick. Mm-hmm. And the stories are just, oh, there's a billion of them. That happens all the time. The young man that got pepper sprayed in his own home.
Mm.
The young girl that called the cops and said that the black people robbed her. So they detained the black neighbor for hours and hours and hours until like a four-year-old said, no, that's the wrong color.
Yeah. You know? There's I think it's a 12-year-old boy who the case is still pending here in Philadelphia that was assaulted so badly by the police. They crushed his testicles. Like, he had to have surgery. This is a 12-year-old boy. What could he have been doing?
And the description that he fit was of like a 30-something-year-old man.
It's just crazy.
Literally.
It's crazy.
Literally.
They don't care.
Well, since we're talking about craziness, you had the promo for the Ferguson National Response Network night.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I guess maybe if you allow me to share, but there's been a lot of weirdness with organizing and running that.
So much weirdness.
Well, so I don't want to get into like the overt racist stuff because there's unfortunately, a lot of that.
Mm.
And I will say this, that it's clear to me that, A, that the network, the Tumblr, is being seen and that it's having an impact. And I know this. I measure and gauge it not only by the number of cities, up to 90 and counting, but by the hate that comes back in the form.
So much hate.
Just the absolute, just disgusting hate. But there was the one guy who misspelled the N-word. Literally in his, like, hateful screed, like, and maybe he was trying to be mad at people from the country of Niger. I don't know.
He was like, you Niger.
I just couldn't believe it. It was like, that's how stupid you are. You're so goddamn dumb and ignorant. You can't even spell the epithet that you're trying to hurl at my wife.
Ridiculous.
It was like, it's racist as fuck, but it kind of made me laugh too.
It was funny to see their misspelling in it. Sometimes they do the misspelling because they think it's like Ebonics or Blacks, you know, they're trying to be funny, but this one was just, he's an idiot.
No, it wasn't
you
very
Niger.
It wasn't articulate, but it was misspelling the N-word. It was just like, what a dumb fuck.
So
the other thing I saw that maybe we can do like a role play with it, but so the form has some people will fill it out and there'll be duplicates in the same city. And it hasn't happened a lot, but you've been really kind of like judicial about it and said, hey, listen, you two both submitted the form. Why don't you kind of work together? And every instance, people are like, oh, you're right. I didn't know this group is here. Or they're going to do something the day of. We're going to do something the day after.
Right. Mostly it's been like really like, oh, great. That's more people we can get.
Right.
You know, kind of this attitude of the bigger, the better. So, and it's been great connecting people. The one, the events that are planned here in Philadelphia in response to the grand jury announcement, I think right now there's like 8 different organizations locally that are involved in it. And it's wonderful to see these small grassroots organizations pooling together their resources. The committee of people that are planning these things are all from these different organizations. And so I've been trying to, you know, as I see information coming from the same cities, just link people together because it's just, you know, the bigger, the better. It's
absolutely
in terms of showing support and doing something that coming out of this. So, yeah.
Do you have the
so the one city that did have some issues with
the sole holdout.
Yeah. Was Oakland. And it was unique because I had announcements submitted for the same location on the same day at 4 different times. Sorry, 3 different times. So this was even more a cause of me being like thinking it would be the easiest thing. Just pick a time.
Yeah, you're all in the same
area.
You're
going the same exact spot. Not the same area, the same corner.
Yeah.
It's Oscar Grant Corner, 14th and Broadway in Oakland. It's like specific. And I was like, oh, this will be the easiest one out of all of them. They just need to like decide, okay, one was at 4, one was at 5, one was at 7. Just pick a time, 6:30, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
And everybody would do this. So I just kind of tagged
Bay Area.
So apparently this stirred some sort of brouhaha.
Yeah. So there's a Facebook post where you mentioned, say, hey, listen, we're doing this. You've got all these different conflicts.
Yeah.
Let's figure this out. And instead of like every other city, dozens and dozens said, great, thank you so much. They started a like comment fight, like in the thread on the Facebook post.
Right.
So why don't you read, I don't want to say the name, but the person starts with a B.
Okay.
You start with that and I'll be the other person.
Okay. So the first person that responded just said, hey, thanks for checking in with us. We are working together. I'll be sure to contact the other organization and solidify the time to be definite. I liked that, and I was like, great, I'll just wait to hear back. So here's the first part of it. There have been call-outs for 7 p.m. circulating for an entire week now, and the 4 p.m. by the RCP needs to be dutifully ignored. Dutifully, by the way. Someone suggests that 7 p.m. is too late. So your plan is to start mobilizing at 5 p.m.? What does that even mean, literally? And are people just going to wait around until 7?
We made the coolest flyer, so they're going to win. And seriously, this right here is a classic example of leftist infighting. People will be out whenever they want, regardless of affiliations. Stop being a pain in the ass.
It's not about who made the flyer. Why attribute it to us anyway? It's about one call out being made first, followed by various left groups trying to capitalize on it by calling for their rally first. It's not a leftist infighting when only one side identifies with the left. And it's all about organizations, or specifically alphabet soup front groups for socialist political parties recuperating autumnus activities.
Can we just that sentence? Good Lord. Sorry, I broke character. Sorry.
Yes. Right. Get back in it.
You say a lot, yet you say so little. It's obvious it's your flyer. You're the only one posting it. And you need to control.
That flyer is being posted everywhere by all sorts of people.
Now.
And you know with absolute certainty that the first instance of the flyer appeared on our Facebook page? LOL.
So many weak points in your posturing and arguments. If you could only see. Been trying to point them out. Eventually you'll see why your message is not resonating towards any sort of revolution or change, falling on deaf ears in an echo chamber.
Yeah. End scene.
Well, no, there's one more. His last one. Oh, it's not. Oh, no.
No, because that was a reply to me. Yeah. So, yeah.
But seriously, like, come on. And you know what? Honestly, I don't know, but I'm gonna go on a limb here. These are both white dudes.
Definitely.
Right? Like, both white dudes.
For sure.
Arguing about, like, and the one guy's sentence about, like, you know, regardless of affiliations, people be out there, blah, blah, blah. And it's so crazy. Like, are you really, is the argument about who, like, are we trying to change things? Are we trying to get people to show up to this thing in your name? Like, what's the goal, right? Am I right?
Yeah, I agree. And again, I thought this was some of the other places, they weren't even meeting the same place. They weren't even doing it the same day, and they were able to come together. These guys are doing the same exact location and can't pick a time. I mean, it's just insane. It's kind of funny. Anyways, so social justice work is funny sometimes. That's one of the funnier parts.
Entertaining.
What's not so funny is the shitty journalistic integrity of our media, though.
How so?
Well, you know, I put together the Tumblr. Been over a week now. It's been up. It's got like 91 cities and all of that. And I saw it referred to in several large media publications, CNN, Huffington Post, USA Today, as a group calling itself the Ferguson National Response Network.
Literally called it a group?
Yes, a group calling itself that, which is just funny because it's really just me and my iMac. And nobody has even seen fit to try and find out who it was. And, like, it's so easy to find me. It's a Tumblr. It's not, like, secret.
Yeah, it's not. You didn't put your name on it, but it wouldn't be hard to dox you either.
No, I mean, it's not even about the doxing parts. Like, you could, I mean, no one's called me. No one's asked me anything about it. No one's even
submitted the form saying, hey, who are you? Call me. I'm with
no,
the news.
No.
I love that they think it's a group. Right?
Let's keep it that way. Nobody listens to our podcast anyway, so it's fine. They won't hear me saying it now, but it's funny. It's funny to me to see it because I have to chuckle and laugh like, oh, it's a group. It's a nefarious protester group out there. It's like, no, it's just me in a Google form. It's not really, it's not that serious.
On the flip side, look at what response you and a Google form and a computer and some time have had. Like, correct me wrong, you haven't spent a penny.
Nope.
There's been no marketing, promotion, advertising invested other than tweeting it,
yep.
Right? Or putting it on Facebook.
Facebook, Twitter, normal channels. Yeah.
So I think when people talk about, like, you know, what can I do? Like, well, here, you did this. All it took was a little bit of time, right?
Yeah.
Maybe a lot of time.
Well, a lot of time, but yeah.
But that's all it took. There was no cost. There was no infrastructure. All the tools were there. You just, you know, coalesced it, pulled it together, and said, here.
It's true.
And the sad thing is nobody was fucking doing it.
No.
Right? Nope.
That's the only reason why. Someone was like, oh, thank you for doing it. It's like, I wish I didn't have to fucking do it.
Yeah, it would be nice for the
I wish to God
NAACP,
the people that have a lot of money and actually get grants and donations and everything would actually be doing this work. I wish. They're not, though. So,
that'd be
you know,
nice.
What can you do?
Yeah. Well, I know we're not podcasting this week, and I don't want to be all heavy. We should have some light stuff. But,
sure.
You were telling me about a controversy with the Serial podcast?
Yeah. So,
I'm not aware of this.
Yeah. So Serial is the first spinoff podcast from This American Life, and it's a little bit different. In fact, it's kind of the opposite of This American Life. It's they unfold one nonfiction story week by week over the course of an entire season, and they stay with the story until they get to what they consider to be the bottom of it. So this first season that launched, I think, about 8 or 9 weeks ago, is about the murder of a Korean American girl named Hae Min Lee. This happened in 1999. She was a senior in Baltimore County, Maryland. She disappeared and her body turned up a month later. Her 17-year-old ex-boyfriend, Adnan Saeed, was arrested for the crime and convicted and sentenced to spend the rest of his life in prison. And so we pick up the story last year, pretty much 2013, where Sarah Koenig, who is the host and EP of the show Serial and was also with This American Life, is investigating the story and to figure out, did Adnan do this or did somebody else?
Right.
So, okay.
And I just, for me, I've been... I don't want to say enjoying the podcast,
sure.
But so I like This American Life. I like Hourglass. I like the work they do. And I found this an interesting departure. And I felt they did a really good job. And I think they do that in general with their podcast. But so the story is more about Sarah trying. So this person's in prison, death row, been convicted. So they're not necessarily trying to like change that. But they're trying, at least for me as a listener, it seems like I'm going along the journey of Sarah trying to understand this case more clearly.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So I feel they've done a good job with that. So I'm I don't know what the controversy is. So do share. Do tell me.
Well, there's just been – I wouldn't even – well, first of all, I'll preface this with saying that it literally has become in this 8 to 9 week period the most popular podcast in the history of the medium. So it is
– What does that mean in terms of streamers, listeners?
All of the above. It is huge. I mean, it's a phenomenon. It's – we've never seen anything like it. It's pushing this concept of what a podcast could be to a whole different level. And also it's using it in a different way that it's been used previously. I mean, we do a podcast and it's very conversational. This is investigative podcasting, but you don't get it at the end of each episode. So it's a little bit different. It's kind of like a radio. That's why they call it Serial. It's like those old radio shows where you tune in next week and you can see what happens with Annie or whatever it is.
I didn't know it was the most popular. That's interesting.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. So last week, two writers, Julie Carey Wong and J. Caspian Kang, wrote specifically that they found a few issues with the podcast itself, specifically some racial issues, and the fact that everybody that's making this story, the EP, the host, the producer, and the editorial advisor are all white, three white women and one white man and one Ira Glass, and kind of this white reporter privilege and kind of cringing a little bit at some of the, I guess, brushes with racial identity that occur, especially because, as you mentioned, the story is told from Sarah's point of view. It's a little bit, and this was something that happened to me a little bit too.
And when you say brushes, you mean because the subjects in the story, because Adnan and what's the young woman's name that was killed?
Hae Min Lee.
Hae Min Lee. Mm-hmm. Because is he Middle Eastern?
Muslim, yes. And Hae Min Lee is Korean. And Jay, who's the main third figure, who's the main witness. The main witness and the reason why Adnan was arrested and convicted is a black person. So these are the three players in this puzzle. And here's this white reporter that's reporting about it. And so there's two distinct, I guess three technically, but two immigrant cultures that she's brushing up against. And you could tell she's a little uncomfortable sometimes when she refers to things that have to do with that. She didn't quite understand like why dating each other would be so weird between the two. But this most recent episode, which is The Trouble with Jay, which is the black character.
Okay.
There were a few things that I just was kind of like, I don't know, just struck me as a little off as well.
And do you have any, what was the, I thought you read an example. You said it to me and I didn't catch what you're saying.
Yeah,
about.
There was one part where she was talking about Jay and somebody was describing him and they said that he wasn't in the magnet program, which both Adnan and Heyman Lee were in. He was in Gen Pop. And she says, Sarah says, their words, not mine. It meant the main part of the school, like general population
like
in the prison.
Yeah.
She says this is what she says on the air. And okay. It just bristled to me. And she makes a lot of different quotes like that. She mentions, like, Jay didn't come from the same kind of household as a lot of other kids he hung around with. He lived with his grandparents and his mom, but his friends say it seemed like he was more or less taking care of himself. He always had a job. His mother depended on him. So she's building this picture of this stereotypical black youth, despite the fact that both Hay and Adnan both had jobs. Hay's father was not in her life either. It's just kind of weird. I thought it was a little bit strange.
We've talked about this before, that sometimes, at least for me, and I've on my evolution of understanding, I've had to get better at this. If it feels a little like, if the little spidey sense, like your little like racist, like, you know, nerve is kind of tingling, there's probably something there, right? It's like that gut sense is usually, especially for people of color, it's dialed in. So if someone's telling me, like, you know, hey, I don't know exactly why this is brushing me the wrong way, but something you said sort of is, I'll take that definitely under advisement. Like, oh, okay, that was, I don't want that to be the case. That's going to detract from my message. Like, I'll listen to that, understand it. You know what I'm saying? Like,
right. I'm going to read just one small piece from Julie Carey Wong. Her piece is really great. It's in BuzzFeed, and I'll have it in the show notes. But she says, Koenig even suggests that the state and Adnan's jury were more likely to believe Jay's testimony because of his race. Quote, Jay seemed like the underdog. It's Baltimore. Half the jury is black. 7 out of 12, actually. Jay probably comes off as this nice young man, and this white lady is yelling at him, end quote. The white lady being Adnan's lawyer. The idea that Jay or any black person would be treated as more trustworthy by this country's criminal justice system by virtue of his blackness is just an astoundingly ignorant suggestion for anyone to make. Whether or not black jury members were predisposed to believe him, Jay had already run the gauntlet of the police and prosecutors in a system designed to criminalize him. The fact that he made it through without being incarcerated is remarkable. That Serial has stepped in to criminalize him in the state's stead is infuriating.
And this is the critique that...
That's the critique.
Okay.
So, of course, like with most things that involved white people, everybody had to run to Sarah Koenig's defense because God fucking just, God forbid, that anybody of color, regardless of their color, try and make white people feel bad about listening to something that they enjoy.
Don't you come after my fucking NPR, goddammit. This American Life, I will stomp you with my spectacles.
Don't you do it. Don't you do it.
Nutty.
So they posted all of these things. Not problematic. This is from the New York. This is from the Observer. In defense of Serial. Charges of problematic racism won't stick to the greatest podcast ever. By Lindsay Bearstein.
Well, and even her fucking byline. Like, if it's the greatest podcast ever, why does it need you to... Is it immune from questions of this sort? Is it, are we not able to have some sort of, you know, like, hey, you know, they're not, and best I can tell, the first woman, Julia, didn't say like, take this off the air, fuck this podcast, it's horrible. She's just saying like, hey, listen, I'm telling you that this bristled me and this is why. And the response is to squash it with a op-ed saying, I just don't even know where to begin.
It's kind of weird. You can read, and again, I'll put the two pieces and also this defense of it. The best is that I told you the first one was not problematic in defense of Serial, and somebody else wrote one called The Problem with the Problems with Serial. So Jay wrote another response that said, The Problem with the Problems with the Problems with Serial.
Oh, my Lord.
Which I just thought was brilliant of him. He's great. He actually just got hired by The New Yorker, so you'll be seeing a lot more from him. It's fantastic.
The Problems with the Problems
with the Problems with Serial. Yes.
And that's what
so it's like you can't even allow these people of color to have a voice and say, hey. And they both admit to enjoying the show. They're not saying it's a bad show. They're just bringing up these things that they noticed as members of these specific groups that are dealt with within the show. And that they felt that some of the reporting rang hollow because of the point of view of the narrator and main character in the story, who is a white woman. It's like, how can you be mad at them for saying that? You know, it's something that you would, if you are the white woman journalist, you should invite that kind of conversation. One, they're talking about your product. They're not accusing you of anything. They're dissecting it. They're making it something that is to be talked about and scrutinized. And, you know, I don't know. I just feel like, why wouldn't you want your product to be talked about that way?
Yeah, this
to be analyzed, to be discussed, to be the topic of a dinner conversation and have people have different point of views on it. Why is consensus necessary? Well, why do we all have to like
it? It's not even consensus, babe. It's that part and parcel of the sort of inability of white people to in any way have any kind of dialogue about race, right? So here's somebody saying, hey, listen, there's something about this. Maybe we should talk about it. No, God damn it. How dare you say anything? Like, they're just bullying these two authors that had opinions, minorities. They're bullying them. It's the whole, you know, like, as soon as somebody interjects race inappropriately, they get to, on the one hand, say, I didn't make an epithet. It's not overt. It's not about race. And as soon as me or someone else or any liberal says, hey, wait a minute, that was kind of problematic, you're fucking playing the race card. Quit race baiting, you reverse racist. Like, they shout down any possible dialogue about this aspect. It's just crazy to me. Absolutely crazy. There's just, we're neutered to the ability to have any kind of fucking dialogue because this, as soon as race is a part of it, and let's, you know, let's call a thing, race is a fucking part of everything. As soon as somebody brings it up, it's like these walls go up where you just can't even fucking talk about it. It's insanity.
Yeah. And then you get people tweeting things like this. This is one, Thomas Pardee at P-A-R-D-E-E. If white people universally love something, there will inevitably be a think piece making them feel guilty about it. One, Tom Gara at Tom G-A-R-A. The new Goodwin's Law is how long can we enjoy a good thing? Good thing is capitalized, by the way, before it's denounced as white privilege.
I just, both of those statements are inherently designed to squelch any possible discussion, dialogue, or opposition. Really, they are. And those statements are so privileged in themselves.
It's just crazy.
I just, you know what, white people, here's another PSA. We have owned everything since forever. Take the criticism. It's okay. Just deal with it. It'll be okay. That's our penance, white people.
Someone points out that Koenig is Jewish. She's not exactly white.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
I'm just looking. He actually storified their responses. It's pretty. I'll include the link in the show notes. It's just kind of crazy to me.
I do like the show. I haven't heard the episode that you're referencing.
It's just like, and cue the backlash. Just, it's like, discussion is not a fucking backlash.
Yeah. Well, you know, and we talked about on our podcast, the Race Forward and the Color Lines and stuff. They just had their conference. I haven't seen or heard anything about it. They've been
exactly
real quiet.
They took a lot of fucking money is what they took.
Well, but when they critiqued, dear white people, when they critiqued the fuck hate, it wasn't a, as these two authors have done, as Julia has done and Jay have done. It wasn't, you know, both Julia and Jay went and said, hey, listen, we're just saying this might be problematic. I'm not really exactly sure, but this kind of, maybe there's something here. Versus Colorline saying, they missed the mark. They didn't talk about this at all.
Right.
They're terrible.
Right.
We have a real big problem with fuck hate. Like, you can have a dialogue about something that maybe is problematic. And in fact, it's needed. Because if people did something that's problematic, like, let's talk about microaggressions, mm-hmm. right? So when people use microaggressions, if I were to come out and say every time somebody uses a microaggression, you're a fucking racist, you motherfucker, like, they wouldn't learn anything. It wouldn't be much of a dialogue about it. Instead, if I said, hey, you know, I understand where your heart's coming from when you said, I don't see color, and I believe everyone should get along. I get what you're trying to imply, but I want you to be aware that that's called microaggression, and here's why that's not appropriate, and here's what you've done. You've invalidated. That's very different than, like, you're a fucking racist. You know what I mean?
Right.
And I feel like the response to Jay and to Julia is the sort of, like, you're a fucking race-baiting piece of shit.
It's,
like,
true.
They've come so strong.
And it's so funny to me. It's like, oh, so you're saying that just these two people bringing up some issue that they had somehow takes away your enjoyment? enjoyment of something, it doesn't even make sense as an argument.
Yeah, who wrote the piece about the Goodwin's Law? Like, really? Jay and Judith? You're giving an awful lot of power to these two opinions.
Like, these two opinions. It's not like they're calling for Serial to be taken off of iTunes. I mean, literally. They're like, we really like the show, but something about this made me feel a little bit strange. And they started talking about what those things were. So what? It is a little bit strange that she kind of paints this picture of both of these students' parents being completely out of touch, tiger-like parents that didn't have any idea what their children were doing.
Yeah.
That's weird.
And, you know, maybe there's a whole discussion about this. I'm also having this, like, slight epiphany. The white privilege aspect of not being able, not ever needing to step outside of our comfort zone is somewhat paradoxically positioned with when there are generalizations made, we think they're about us specifically.
Always.
Right? Like, dear white people wasn't
always
dear Drew, right? Yeah. Wasn't dear this guy sitting right here. Like, I can watch that and be like, well, that's not me. They're not talking about me. Yet, like, 99.9% of white people are like, oh my God, they're talking about me. Like, no, it wasn't dear your name. It was dear, like, white people.
Yeah.
Right? Like, this opinion piece wasn't like, you know, anyone who's listening to Serial, you're a piece of shit listening to this racist crap. No, that wasn't the title.
Right.
That wasn't the think piece. But that's how they're reacting to it. They're responding as if it was like, he fucking came into my living room and called me a piece of shit for enjoying this thing. I'm gonna respond with a sledgehammer.
I don't want anybody ever making me feel guilty about anything ever. Not never, not no
we
way.
We need a soundbite that's just like, the privilege. The privilege.
Oh, the privilege.
What was the Apocalypse Now? When it's like, the horror. That would be like, the privilege. The privilege.
Maybe we'll try and get a few people to do it over Thanksgiving when everybody's here.
The privilege.
The privilege.
It's so deep.
We could layer them. The privilege. The privilege.
The privilege.
The privilege. The privilege. I think we should do it. It'll be funny. Okay, I think that's it for today, yeah?
All right. We go long? What do? We keep it an hour?
It's a little longer than an hour, but it's all right.
Juliet, Carl, and maybe if there's a third listener, you could tweet us.
Yeah, tweet it. We'll say your name,
Say your name.
Happily.
Shout out.
Shout it
listener
out.
Listener number three to be John.
Whoever you are.
We're trying to keep it to an hour, but sometimes I've been told I'm verbose. Low squashes.
No, it was a good discussion about the boycott thing, too. That usually we don't have a segment that long, but you know, when you have a guest, you want to give them a chance to shine. And also, it was a great discussion and one that needs to be had. I think it'll be something people will be talking about a lot in the coming months and years.
Yeah.
It's a long, long slog we're going to be going through to flip this thing around.
Well, you know what we got to do is get the kids' lists for the holiday and buy it before Black Friday. Because I really appreciate Leah and the work she's doing, and I believe in it. I do think that Black Friday through January something is that's a lot. That's hard to
not shop at all. I think
to not shop
avoid
at
Walmart.
All.
I think it's doable.
Walmart's doable.
I think it's doable
to not shop at all.
And they were just asking for people to not shop at all on Black Friday. They were asking for them to target only Black owned businesses and to avoid specific ones that they're listing the rest of that time. So the only day they're asking for zero shopping is Black Friday itself.
I'll tell you, if these retailers, I don't know who just announced it, they're opening at 6 a.m. on Thanksgiving Day. Is it Macy's?
But you know what? There's been a lot of pushback about this whole thing. People are like, don't shop on Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
These people should get to spend time with their
Agreed.
Families too. It's nothing fucking sacred anymore. Kind of thing.
I'll just say, me personally, there's all sorts of holidays on the calendar. My entire life, Thanksgiving's always been the one. Always been the one that's just all about family.
It is.
You're with family.
There's no gifts involved.
No.
It's just about you guys getting together and being together and being thankful. And they've turned it into like this gross, I don't even know. They've just brought consumerism where it didn't even need to be.
Well, I bet you that's what the thing that's going to do Black Friday in. I hope that the black dollar being pulled out of the equation will have an impact, but it's going to be the moving Thanksgiving shopping further and further up.
Oh, right? It'd be like October 2nd.
Yeah, I mean,
it's the new Black Friday.
I think they had Christmas trees up in Macy's before the candy from Halloween was gone.
Right.
You know, it's like, good criminy. It's nuts. I used to love the season. I just get, I don't say I dread it. I've got fatigue and it's not even, we're not even to like December yet. And I'm already tired of talking about Christmas.
Right. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
It's too much.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so you don't even talk about any pop culture and any TV shows?
You know, we haven't been watching TV. We had these things going on and maybe next episode we'll do like a pop culture heavy one.
Yeah. I just want to lift up Parenthood. It's their final season.
It is.
It's been so good. And the dynamic with Matt and his mom, when he asked the girl out and he totally like basically, you think he embarrassed himself and all her friends were saying it was embarrassing. And his mom chases him down and she corners him and you don't know what she's going to say. And it was so perfectly written that she's like, listen, you know, that wasn't embarrassing. That was beautiful and from the heart. And you're going to love again and you're going to know it's right when she loves you back the same way. And I thought, just what a great, as a mom, you know, that she had it's an actress, but the writers had the presence of mind to not allow that moment, A, to go unnoticed for Max in his life, but then for her to have this sort of really beautiful response, you know? And she was proud. She was so proud that here's her, you know, on the spectrum son, able to feel comfortable enough asking a woman out and doing this sort of loving gesture. I thought it was just great.
Yeah,
I love that show so much.
That show's really great. They're just doing
They better get... I'm telling you, if Joel and Julia don't get together, I'm gonna go through and punch Craig T. Nelson in the face or something. They need to get them together.
They might like kill him or something, though. I'm worried about that.
Yeah, they
more.
Haven't had anybody die in a while. It is the end.
Mm-hmm.
If you're gonna have somebody die, the patriarchs.
Now's the time. Mm-hmm.
Well, if you're looking for a show to catch up on or Netflix, Parenthood this season's been awesome.
Yeah, it sure has been. All right, babe. Well, that's it. Episode 16. I know the White Privilege podcast came out yesterday, episode 3, and you have a guest, Amy, right?
Amy Steven, yeah.
Amy Steven.
Sorry for the delay, y'all. It took me forever. I don't do the editing, and you left town. I couldn't do it. I couldn't upload it. And then when I did try to upload it, the thing broke, and I had to go if people understand what this means, but like I had to go into cPanel. I had to find the WordPress config
file. They don't care. They don't care.
I had to fucking do this shit that, like,
care.
I'm not good at that.
They don't care.
That's not my strong suit.
It doesn't really matter.
And then I broke it, right? The whole site went down for like an hour and a half.
Yeah, well, you know, it happens.
I didn't even tell you just how worried I was.
Well, anyways. And I will be recording a new episode of No Bitch Left Behind on Saturday. So you guys will see that. And I think that's it. Actually, I'm going to be on Fox 29 on Saturday. So I'll post that on our website.
For the Ferguson Response Network?
Yeah.
Someone did some actual investigative work?
Well, yeah. Two people so far. We'll see what happens.
And is this a local Philly affiliate?
It is. It's the local Philadelphia Fox station. I'm going to be in a panel discussion. And there's going to be a former police officer, myself, and I think two other people. So it should be interesting.
Oh boy,
should be interesting.
All right, they don't know what they opened up a Pandora's box getting you on that panel.
We'll see what happens.
All right, congrats.
All right, babe. I guess that's it for now. Again, you can find us online on our website, Interracial John. That's JAWN.com, or on iTunes or Stitcher Radio. Just search Interracial John. We're also on Tumblr, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook at Interracial John. And we follow back from that account on Twitter. So that's Interracial John, JAWN. All right, that's it. High five.